Okay, let's begin to talk. Now, I understand, if I'm not mistaken, my informant tell me that your wife is also a cantor.
That's true.
In a slightly different tradition.
Right, she's in a reform.
That's something, of course, that really interests me about your particular setup, that you get to have that kind of counterpoint there.
We happen to be extremely fortunate in that her job is 25 minutes from my job.
Mm-hmm.
And the availability of two jobs in such close proximity doesn't always present itself.
Right. It's a little like academic life, right? The same.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And we're just very fortunate. In fact, Martha was a student cantor in Edison before I even met her.
Mm-hmm.
I met her shortly after coming to Springfield. It was very convenient that she was there and I was in Springfield, and it was just very, it was wonderful. I hope that we can both stay where we are for many years.
Now, do you compare notes about your, of course, about your respective duties and expectations and what goes on in there?
We really do. We really do. There are times that Martha can make suggestions to me, and there are times that I can make suggestions to her.
Mm-hmm.
Vis-a-vis the temple politics, also in terms of music.
Yeah. What are the big differences musically in these expectations in your two places?
My congregation, I would say, musically, is a very folksy type-oriented kind of music program.
Hmm.
They would be perfectly happy singing the same music every Friday night.
I think most congregations I've heard about so far are like that.
They would be perfectly happy doing that, and only because I can't do that for professional reasons do I vary it. But I have to be very careful to the degree to which I vary it.
Mm-hmm.
Because then you'll get people complaining, how can we be changing all the melodies?
Yeah.
So it's got to be done, you know, one every week or, you know, one every 2 weeks, but you can't come and change.
Sure.
Then you always have someone who doesn't come for 6 weeks, comes in and finds a different service and says, how can we change the whole service?
Yeah. Now, what's her situation? Does she have more flexibility?
Well, her situation is such that, first of all, I think the music that she does there is a very much different kind of music. Though there is congregational singing, she also has an ability to do much more singing than I do that's not congregational. And when you're not bound to congregational singing, then you can always vary more and more with much more freedom,
mm-hmm.
much more flexibility.
Now, she has an organ and a choir. And
she has a volunteer choir that she has started since she went full-time, which is only this past year, so I think they've performed once or twice.
And you don't?
I have a volunteer choir that performs occasionally on Friday nights and on high holidays.
But not an organ?
I have an organ Friday night and on the holidays, but I don't have it for Shabbat morning.
Huh. So there's a certain difference, but is it a big difference then in terms of... Is the repertoire very different? You don't do the music that she does?
Even though most of it is different because the whole structure of the service is different.
Right.
Though mine is a very left-wing conservative congregation, we still adhere to the structure of the conservative service,
mm-hmm.
with very little change. The Reform service has umpteen different number of services in Gates of Prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a different service every Friday night.
Mm-hmm.
Though there are some parts of the liturgy that might be the same, the whole complexion of the service is different.
So when you bring in the organ and the choir, what kind of music do you do with them?
I generally do traditional kind of music. I would say that most of the music that I do with the organ and the choir was not originally written for organ. Let's say it's certainly not the classical Reform type music. If anything, it's the more Eastern European music,
mm-hmm.
and the organist accompanies from open score.
What do you mean open score?
Well, there's no written organ part.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so he would actually work through the music and decide what he's going to play based on the quiet part.
Oh, so he kind of improvises it, or?
Right. I happen to be very fortunate in as much as I have an organist who can do that.
So what kind of music would that be? What sort of pieces do you use?
Well, let me give you an idea. On a given Friday night, we could start with the Charlene Shalom Aleichem, which is probably one of the newest pieces that we do. We'll do the Novakovsky Matovu, sometimes the Lewandowski Matovu, although that Matovu has been done so many times that I took the time to teach them the Novakovsky because I wanted a change. We'll do the Zilbert's Avat Olam. We can do the Ansis Hashkivenu, the one written for tenor, not baritone, in F minor. Or the Helfman Hashkivenu.
So when you get into Helfman, that's also things that are shared by Reform?
Right. But whereas Martha's Choir is just getting underway, they're not ready to sing a piece like Helfman's Hashkivenu yet, because that's that's a more complicated
piece.
But
there would be then some overlap in repertoire.
Oh, yeah.
That you could,
sure.
That you could do.
Sure, I'm sure that the Lachado D that Martha sings on an ordinary Friday night would probably be the same melody that I could just as easily sing.
Yeah, I'm interested in trying to find, you know, distinctions and overlaps, because it seems to me there's more overlap than I thought. I mean, to me, when I first got into this, in various ways, and how people are trained, or what's taught, or what people might sing.
Well, what you have to understand is that while my congregation is a very liberal, conservative congregation, Martha's congregation is a very traditional Reformed congregation. Traditional in the sense of traditional vis-a-vis traditional music, as opposed to traditional being a classical Reform, because it's anything but classical Reform. So you probably have more of an overlap with regard to those two congregations.
Now, what about the training? Where were you trained?
Well, let me say this. Martha was trained at HUC. She graduated last year. My training was a very interesting training because I did not attend CI. I did not attend HUC. I was born into a family where my father is a noted choir director in this field. And as a kid, I sang in the choir. As an adolescent at 14 or 15, I started conducting the choir. All of my father's friends were chazanim. In those days, they were called chazanim.
Right. I still tend to do that myself.
And a yeshiva education or a day school education, in addition to an intensified private music education, followed up by Brooklyn College music education. That's where I got my education in terms of being a cantor.
Well, that's considerable. But you must be something of an exception. There aren't many people or family trained anymore.
Right.
Although I had a student at Wesleyan who was also family trained, and it really surprised me.
Who was that?
It's a young guy named Erwin Gelman. And he went on to be a scientist, as far as I can tell. He was going on. But he had all this stuff down and had learned it because when he was a kid around the dinner table, they made him sing us this.
Right.
But I would think that must be a handful of people in this generation that grew up that way, compared to that being a reasonably normal thing 50 years ago.
Right. You see, today, if you want to become a cantor, you go to one of the schools.
Yeah.
Now, I really feel that the best way to learn how to daven is to go to shul every Shabbos, and preferably to a different shul every Shabbos. So you hear this one, you hear that one, or the next one. But that, of course, has to run together with having a good music background. You can go every Shabbos, and if you have no music background, you're not going to learn anything.
Right, yeah.
You also have to have a good Hebrew background. But if you have those two, then I think the best way to learn is to go every Shabbos to shul, without exception. One of the problems in terms of going to school to be a cantor is that you go to school and then you have to have some form of support, and so you get a student pulpit. As soon as you have that student pulpit, you're isolating yourself from the rest of the world, and you really don't know what your colleagues are doing.
So that's difficult. So, yeah, you really think a lot of exposure is the key to picking up. So in the institutes, you get a certain amount, because they bring in a few different people, but you're still not getting a lot.
Right. I mean, you're getting the very best education that is available today in an American society.
Yeah. Now, so do you feel you lost out on something by not going through that procedure?
No, I really don't. I really don't, because Nusach, I know.
Mm-hmm.
In Hebrew, I'm fluent. Musically, I'm sure I can hold my own.
You had the practical experience very young. You were able to write.
Yeah. I had the practical experience musically, and coupled with the music background and education that I received as a youngster, my musicianship is, it exceeds what would be required of an ordinary cantor.
Sure.
So in answer to your question, I don't think that I missed out.
Do you use the printed sources, or where do you get your repertoire? And do the Cantor Assembly publications? Or the
Cantor's Assembly publications. My father has a great deal of repertoire, some
mm-hmm.
of which,
yes, right. you got
know,
a lot
some of,
which
yeah. I use and some of which I don't use.
Nowakowski seems to be somewhat unusual, no? Things you believe in bringing the traditional older things as well as newer material.
Right. I think that you can have a good balance. I think that Jewish music today is going through a metamorphosis.
Mm-hmm. As it always has been.
Exactly. I don't think that the extreme changes are going to last.
What do you mean by extreme?
I don't think that guitar music is going mm-hmm. to last. I can say quite candidly, I hope that it doesn't last.
Yeah.
It's sort of like you go as far as you can go, and then you look back and say, what have we done? And then, well, maybe we should really, instead mm-hmm. of going all the way over to one direction, let's move back just a little bit. So I think that there is room, especially in congregations that are oriented in congregational singing,
mm-hmm.
I think there is room for a more lively type of music.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe music not on quite a high level,
mm-hmm.
maybe music written in unison instead of harmonized.
But where is that going to come from, that music?
I think it's being written today.
Who's writing things that aren't from
guitars
or from... Yeah.
I myself have written music
uh-huh.
for the Friday night service.
Mm-hmm.
Now, while I might prefer to write grandiose music, a cantor and choir and organ, or cantor and choir and orchestra. To be more practical, I've written congregational music for cantor and congregation
mm-hmm.
that can either be assisted by organ or without organ.
Mm-hmm.
It became obvious to me that in my own congregation, there was an element, and surprisingly enough, not the younger element, but the middle-aged element that has this complex about the younger element.
Yeah.
Okay, if you know what I mean, it's the middle-aged people that are beginning to feel, gee, we have to do something to bring the young people in.
Mm-hmm.
Young people might not necessarily want to be brought in, or might not necessarily want that kind of music,
mm-hmm.
because it's not what they learned 15 years ago when they were being bar mitzvahed, or 20 years ago when
mm-hmm.
they were being bar mitzvahed. But it's that guilt trip that the middle-aged people are experiencing,
mm-hmm.
but I felt that need, and I felt, well, as long as I have to sing that kind of music, I might as well write it and sing my own.
Okay. That's interesting. What about other sources of Hasidic music? Seems to be creeping in.
Do you mean Hasidic music or neo-Hasidic
music?
Well,
whatever, yeah.
It's creeping in, but it's not creeping into my congregation because I'm not allowing it to.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that there's any place for it there because a good deal of it does not conform to the Nusach. It's just a melody.
Yeah.
Chances are some of the people who wrote the music had no idea what Nusach was all about.
Right.
and chances are it was not written by Hasidim.
Right. What about authentic Hasidic music? Are you interested in that?
Authentic Hasidic music is great. I have used some.
Mm-hmm.
I have used some, even in my congregation, which is less traditional. But I do use it, because some of it is very good.
Mm-hmm. And what other kinds of influences are now in the air that are coming in? Is there anything from Israel now that's making any impact?
Well, immediately, no. Not to my knowledge, anyway. I know that there was, when Hallelujah, the song that won the Eurovision Award, came out, there were people at my congregation that absolutely flipped over that piece.
Mm-hmm.
They thought it was the greatest thing since Kimitzion. And they were very eager to sing it, but it wasn't part of the service.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I couldn't include it in the service. I wasn't about to. They would have loved for the Hebrew school kids to sing it.
Mm-hmm.
I specifically didn't teach it. Because something bothered me about that. Having a group of kids get up and sing, I have no idea what they're singing. Maybe they'll sing in tune, maybe they won't sing in tune.
Mm-hmm.
They certainly won't be able to count. Why should they? Their parents can't. But this really excites people to get up and see these kids sing.
Yeah.
When it has no meaning whatsoever. You know,
it has a functional meaning, that is, it works. But you're saying
right.
It has no, what, symbolic meaning?
It has no meaning in terms of anything Jewish. To have a kid get up and sing a song that happens to be written with Hebrew lyrics,
yeah,
that has no religious significance.
Mm-hmm. It's not, in short, it's not really sacred text.
Exactly, it's not a sacred
text. That's the borderline,
yeah,
is
but,
there. So.
But the ignorant congregation will get off on it.
Yeah. You seem to be very concerned about preservation of Nusach. Do you think that's common in your generation, or are people less interested than the older people were in that, by and large?
I would hope that it is common. I think that certainly the young cantors that I know in the New Jersey area, I think are every bit as interested in preserving the Nusach.
Hmm.
I can't think of anyone in the conservative congregation who isn't.
The older people, you know, are very worried. They think that it's all coming to an end and it's dying out. And
I don't think so.
Nusach is going to the dogs. And
I don't think so. We have, I happen to be the chairman of the New Jersey region.
Uh-huh.
And we have a handful of young cantors in the region that attend our meetings regularly. And I can't think of anybody there,
mm-hmm,
who would be willing to throw out the Nusach and forget about it.
Now what about the congregations? Are they...
The congregations,
they're not interested,
huh? It's not that they would like to do away with the Nusach. It's that they don't know what it is.
Right, that's what I mean.
It's the ignorance.
Yeah.
More important than that, it's the teachers who will teach in the Hebrew school,
mm-hmm,
who are just as ignorant.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do you do about that? Ignorance, I mean...
I have put an end to a lot of it. I made sure that if the teachers are going to teach a tefillah, that I have taped the tefillah for them first.
Mm-hmm.
So, it took time to erase the problems, because once someone learns something, there's no way of correcting it unless he has a good degree of talent.
Yeah.
So it took time to actually wait until the new crop, let's say the new generation, came into the Hebrew school. But they have to have a tape from me, because if,
mm-hmm,
not, I am the one who controls the music in the synagogue,
mm-hmm,
and I will not permit it. I won't permit them teaching the wrong melody,
mm-hmm,
for the service.
Is that what you think of as the main sort of function of the cantor? is to really hold on to the musical component of this entire apparatus and say, this is, you know, you have some handle on it. Is that the main thing you ought to be doing?
Not necessarily. I think it's a function that I am doing that no one else is trained to do.
Right.
But in terms of a main function, if you stopped someone on the street and said, what is the main function of the cantor? Well, if his son was recently bar mitzvahed, his function is to teach bar mitzvahs.
Right.
And if his mother recently died, then the function is to attend a funeral, to perform the funeral, and to go to a shiva minyan. If you ask someone else, it's to be around to make sure that if someone's in the hospital, they get visited.
What do you feel like there's a core thing that's really the heart of your job? Or is it all those things?
I think I would be looking for trouble if I left out any of those things.
Uh-huh.
Okay, if I didn't put importance on any of those things. But probably because I am the one who is trained in the music, I would have to accept responsibility for that more because there's nobody else to serve that function.
Is music really the heart of ritual? I mean, is it absolutely the basic thing in the sense that you have the texts, but that the texts have to be performed, that they have to be, you know, given out in a musical way? do you think that's what makes a service?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You see, there are those who won't understand the Hebrew. But if I chant a prayer, and assuming I do it well, if I'm able to bring them to a point where they feel uplifted, I think I've done my job.
So that's really, major.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You think that even given their ignorance, it's possible for you to convey that through Nusach, and they will respond. Whether they know what they're responding to or not.
Let's put it this way. There is a group that will respond to a chazanic rendition, whether they understand the text or not. And they might become spiritually uplifted as a result of that experience. There is another group that might derive that same enrichment by singing along in a congregational tune, even though they might not know what the words mean.
Yeah.
It's for that reason that I try to have a good mixture so that everyone can walk away feeling something.
And what actually, do you feel that that term shiliach, is tzibur is then still effective? In what sense are you a shiliach? What is it? Where's the message, and where is it going?
I think there are different levels. There are times where I serve the congregation, as I said before, in terms of trying to uplift them. Then there are times, and I would have to admit that more so on the high holidays than any other time, I really feel the word shaliach would have more significance. Because of the whole nature of the liturgy on the high holidays, because of the themes of the high holidays.
And also because more of them are there?
That really doesn't bother me.
Yeah.
That really would not, it wouldn't have much of an effect on me at all. If the high holidays would cause me to work or rehearse or perform or be anxious or think or whatever preparation is necessary, probably it's because of the amount of concentrated work that
Absolutely.
There is.
It's
more,
massive.
Yeah, more than the number of people who are going to be out there.
Yeah. But it seems to me that the effect, the impact is at its greatest that way, when the people are expecting it, when there's more of them, when there's that atmosphere of intensity that's built up.
That's true. That is very true. They are expecting it, and they're expecting me to do well, and I would say that a great reason for my doing well is because of the fact that they're expecting me to do well, and that has a positive effect on me.
There's a kind of rapport, and there's a relationship between an audience and a whatever you want to call the two parties here. I'm not sure what to call them.
Absolutely. I felt it more this past year than ever before, and that's because this past high holiday season was the fourth high holiday season that I spent in my current congregation. And whereas the first year I looked out and saw a sea of people and knew nobody, the second year I looked out and knew few people, after 4 years I looked out and I knew a great number of people. And then you really get the feeling that you're a shaliach tzibur. Because then you really know the tzibur.
How old are you now?
28.
Wow. Really? You've been doing this a long time, and you're very well into it. It's amazing.
Oh, it's very much a part of me. If I wanted to give it up, I couldn't. In fact, the other day, a woman in the congregation asked me, did you ever consider going into the rabbinate? And I said, well, first of all, if I were going to go back to school for 3 years, it would probably be in a completely different field. But I would still want to come to shul. And what are you doing to me? You want me to have to sit and listen to another chazan?
Very clear. Well, I don't want you to be late for...
Okay, I hope I gave you something.
Oh, yeah.